Hey, this is Derek Jensen on Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest today is Dylan Thompson. Are you there, Dylan?
I am. Hi, Derek.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Good. So should we get started?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So I guess my first question is, I would like to ask how you became interested or involved in radical environmental work.
Sure. Well, I think for me it was a pretty long process, and I don't really remember when I started, having these big questions. But one of the main things that I began to notice just growing up and through school and whatnot was just that there seems to be this antagonism between the process, the big process that I saw all around me in nature, and growing up, this was most easily seen around where I lived, because I lived close to a meadow where there would be a bunch of, communities of non-humans all the time, elk and coyotes and deer and bobcats, and so that was a very real thing to me early on. But then another just as real thing was my own human culture and its activities, which seemed to be going against this other process that was just outside my front door growing up. And so, when I would get in the car with my parents and we would drive somewhere, anywhere really, because I grew up in Western Washington State, where logging is probably the biggest part of economies over there, I would see clear cuts. New clear cuts would pop up everywhere. And they certainly struck me, no doubt, as something ugly. And I didn't know what to really make of it, but I knew on a fundamental level, even though I couldn't articulate it, that there was an antagonism here. There was a process going against the larger process of the earth. And so that's sort of the main fundamental question that's carried me into being interested in that sort of thing, in radical environmentalism. And so getting into college and later on in my schooling, I would be confronted more often with political debates and, what was going on in the White House and overseas and stuff. And those only interested me peripherally, because that larger and more fundamental question was not being addressed by anyone. But I didn't know how to pose that question to anyone or get it into the discourse at all. But then I found people and books and authors and writers like yourself and others who were questioning those things and trying to bring it into the discourse. Alongside this exploration, I was, learning that the situation we're in is extremely dire, and the world is being destroyed at an ever increasing rate. Every living system on the planet is in decline, and the rate of decline is accelerating. And when I would learn these things about there being less than 10% of the large fish in the ocean remaining, and that an average of 55,000 entire species driven extinct every year, and 98% of the world's native forests being gone, and 99% of the world's native grasslands being gone, this all of a sudden took a central role in my life. I think that was the moment when I knew that I had to go down this path. Nothing else really mattered. So all of these things, led me to question, like, okay, is this process that I saw, that I've been seeing from early childhood, natural? Is it inevitable? Is this dominant culture that I was born into, this civilization, was it inevitable that it came about? And is this just the way things are supposed to be? And I quickly discovered that that is not the case, because all it took was an anthropology class at the university I went to see that know, there exists quite a few other cultures. They still exist, and they have existed for our entire tenure on this planet. And these many other cultures do not behave in the same way that this culture does. And in fact, a lot of these non-civilized, non-industrial, traditional cultures that I learned about seem to me to fit into that larger process. They seem to fit into the same process that the elk fit into, as I saw it, that entire meadow that I grew up next to fit into. So this really sparked my interest and got me excited, because all of a sudden I didn't feel that crazy, because I knew that it was possible for humans to live in much more sane ways, in ways that didn't destroy the very foundations of their cultures and the planet. So, you know, some of these cultures that still exist are those like the Awa that still resides in the Brazilian Amazon, along with others like the Yanomami and the Guarani and the Zoe and the Anawani Nawe. And then you can go over to Africa, in Tanzania, there's the Maasai, there's over in Kenya, there's the Ogiek, and in India, the Dongria Khand, in Malaysia, there's the Penan. There's 150 million tribal people in 60 different countries around the world, as disclosed by a great organization called Survival International, the Movement for Tribal Peoples. And so they still exist and are living proof that this culture that we've been born into is not the only way to be and not the only way to do things.
So you've mentioned a few times that larger processes, the larger process that was in the meadow, or processes in the meadow of these non-human communities, and then you've talked about many indigenous peoples have furthered those processes. What process actually are you talking about?
Well, I basically the continuation of life on this planet, as that's as best as I can articulate it. I mean, the way I've seen it is, you know, the elk and all those creatures seem to be living out their lives, just doing what they do, but it all seems to be holding life together, holding the soil together. And you know, I think a good way to talk about this process that I've been referring to, it really became clear to me when I started learning about soil health. And when I learned about, you know, basic ecology, what I learned was that pretty much every living community on this planet is going towards something that ecologists, and I don't know how I feel about all of this terminology, but climax communities is what most living systems are going for. So in this area where I live on the west coast of the United States, pretty much every living community is going towards old growth forest. And so when there's a disturbance in a natural community, let's say, you know, there's a giant flood or even a volcanic eruption or something, anything that exposes the soil down to its bare bones, so that it is exposed, each natural community has a way of healing it. And oftentimes the plants that we refer to as weeds are these sort of first responders who come in and with their roots hold the soil together and prepare the soil by pumping it with certain nutrients that make it ready for the next succession of plants. And so succession, which is a term used in ecology, is the term used to describe that, as different communities will come in and prepare the way for the next community as the ecosystem moves towards equilibrium, which is the climax community. So those are the terms that I've found that best describe what I'm talking about. Just the continuation of life, the continuation of relationship with the land. I guess that would be how I would answer that.
One of the ways I think about this a lot is I keep thinking, you know, when you read accounts of the early European explorers on North America, it's the continent is just unbelievably fecund, you know, with the rivers so full of salmon that you can't see the bottom. And I read even in the 1930s there was a run of salmon that lasted, what was it? It was 12 miles wide and ran out in the ocean, 12 miles wide and lasted for 30 days. And, you know, we know about the flocks of passenger pigeons and Eskimo curlews and so on. And the way I always think about this is how did the world get to be so rich and vibrant? And the answer seems to me that it has to be, it became so rich and vibrant through every creature just living and dying. So the, you know, the salmon come in and they make the forest a better place simply by their existence. And the redwood trees make the forest a better place. By definition, they have to. Otherwise, the redwood forest wouldn't have existed.
Right. Yeah, that's, I think, exactly how I felt about the elk and about, you know, the alder trees in my backyard. I feel like I could understand from an early age, and I feel like a lot of us do, that these creatures and other beings do make the world a better place simply by doing what they're doing and being who they are. And these other human cultures, I think, for me, were a testament that humans can also do that, can also make the world a better place simply by living. But there are some things that have to be in place, I think, for humans to be able to do that. And this leads into, you know, my exploration, you know, why is our culture so antagonistic and so violent, so incredibly violent towards the earth? How could it have annihilated those flocks of passenger pigeons that darkened the sky for days? And I mean, of course, the answers are extremely numerous. But one thing that I've been interested in are just some of the fundamental structural differences between the dominant culture and all of these other cultures that I was looking at, and the part of the structural stuff that I became interested in first was the cultural structure, because I think a society's structure is also what's included in that are the cultural stuff, like the stories that are inherited and passed down, and the systems of belief. And so I knew, and I think this is part of the reason why, when I saw those clear cuts growing up, and when I saw, you know, when we would go into town and I would see a new gravel mine opened up, and it would just, you know, I remember thinking they were ugly, but I couldn't take those feelings farther than just saying, oh, that's ugly, because everything around me, everyone around me was normalizing that sort of behavior. You know, I mean, I remember being inundated with Forest Service or timber company propaganda through middle school. Just, they would have coloring book contests, and they would bring in coloring books with pictures of forests, and they'd be sponsored by Weyerhaeuser or whatever. And so the entire culture was, the stories that I inherited were ones that naturalized and normalized the cutting down of forests. I was brought up to believe that trees were there for us to cut down, for us to build houses with. And one of the first things I learned when I looked into some of the stories that, you know, were passed down in, you know, cultures like the Yanomami and the Dongria Khand, were vastly different. Many cultures have opposite stories. Many cultures, you know, believe that trees are other beings to enter into relationship with, or for some cultures, the forest whom they live next to is the home of a certain god or goddess or something like that, you know. And so I knew that, I knew then that this, the structure of stories and systems of belief were very important in determining the way that people actually behave towards the world. And so, you know, a few specific examples, you know, in the AWA, there's a quote from one of the members of the AWA: if you destroy the forest, you destroy us too. And I don't hear that kind of thing coming a lot from our culture. And the Guarani take the land as the origin of all life. That's the mainstay of their spiritual tradition. I don't really see that in ours. And, you know, one of my favorite examples, and I say favorite not because it's good, but because it's a very stark example of this meeting of these two different stories, of stories that take the world as a resource to be used versus the stories that see the world as made up of other beings to enter into relationship with. Over in India, the Dongriya Khan, who I've mentioned a couple times, they live in the mountains in a part of India, and the specific mountain they live on is named Niyam Dongar, and they deem this mountain sacred. And recently, a British mining company called Vedanta came in and determined that that mountain holds a very large deposit of bauxite, and bauxite is used in the production of aluminum, and so they wanted to blow it up. And this was this is just a very stark example of those two very different worldviews stemming from those different stories meeting. And of course, the question is, you know, how do we judge those stories? And for me, it's clear which one of those cultures will be able to live in place for a lot longer than the other. Because if your stories tell you that the world is a resource to be used, then it seems inevitable that you're going to use it up. Whereas if the mountain you live on is sacred and the forest whom you live next to is the home of the gods, you're probably going to behave a lot differently towards the world.
I'm noticing that you use the word home to describe a forest, and that's A, pretty unusual, and B, I'm sure you've noticed this too, but if you use a word processing program and you type in the forest who, it will attempt to correct you.
And yeah, I have noticed that.
I just bring that up in terms of how deeply embedded those stories are in our language, that even something so small as it being remarkable that you use the word whom to describe a forest.
Which really
leads to the next question of how does one, or how have you, attempted to unlearn the perceptual framework that's been handed to you? Because that seems like, well, a couple things. One of them is, I keep thinking of something that so many indigenous people have said to me, is that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And that seems to be really hard to unlearn those stories that you've told. How did you unlearn from, you know, the Weyerhaeuser propaganda version of what a forest is and what a forest is for to where you are now?
Yeah, that's a long, it's been, you know, a long time coming, and something I've been learning through this whole thing is just how deep, I've learned not to underestimate how deep conditioning goes, because it goes very deep, and unlearning, I think, will be a process, a continual process until the day I die. But I feel like the dominant culture hands us and hands down to us perceptual frameworks that encourage abstraction, that encourage us to abstract ourselves from the world and to abstract our minds from our bodies and our culture is abstracted from the earth, and most of our cultural stories serve to abstract us from our bodies and from the material world. And so...
Just a sec. I just want to point out that I am hearing... Well, I'm actually not hearing your voice. I am hearing a facsimile of your voice that was transmitted over electric wires, and I'm not actually experiencing you as a person right now. I'm just saying this in terms of exactly what we're talking about, what you're talking about, that yes, I think what you're having to say is really great, and I'm not saying, oh my gosh, we shouldn't be doing this interview because it's done by phone. I'm just pointing out that how deeply this abstraction also is embedded in our lives.
Yeah, as I'm talking to you now, I'm talking to you in an apartment that is littered with cordage and machines that, if I so chose, could take me to these other very disembodied worlds. And you're right, it's to talk about it is over these mediums. Sometimes you just, it's everywhere. And we have relationships with these machines on a daily basis, I think, more than we do with the bodily world. At least it seems that way sometimes. But
one more thing. I was pretty horrified a few years ago when I realized that I touch plastic more than I touch human flesh. You know, in terms of, like, right now I'm holding a phone, and I touch plastic certainly more often than I touch tree bark or touch soil, for that matter. Anyway, sorry, I keep interrupting.
That's okay. Yeah, no, it's true, and that's one thing that scares me a lot about particularly people my age. I live in a university town right now, and it just seems like people are this culture is just inundating us with new ways, new fangled ways to disembody ourselves and to make sure that we don't touch tree bark when there's a new groovy app for our phones or whatnot. So, but to reverse that, to try to go against that process, for me personally, because I said I identified what this culture seems to be doing as is abstracting us from the world, the question became, how do we get back into the world? How do we get back in touch, literally, with the world? And, of course, this is going to be a personal journey for everyone, but we're all dealing with varying degrees of alienation. But for me, it's been very helpful to constantly remember certain elemental things that I think one can easily observe but are often, take it for granted, because a lot of us are spending our time lost in our thoughts or in the cyber realm or any number of other worlds that this culture has created for us to hide out in. But some of these elemental things are just simple observations, like, I am a creature who must continually imbibe this substance called air at every moment if I want to continue living. I need to drink water, and my body is made up of mostly water. I have to eat rocks, and my body is made up of a substantial amount of salt. And so, I mean, I have to remember that my very flesh is made up of the flesh of the world. And what these observations suggest to me is that what we usually call our body, this human form, is not nearly as defined, not nearly as separate from the world that I was encouraged, to believe by this culture. It's not nearly as separate as I was taught to believe. Our bodies are very continuous and very dependent upon the larger body of the world. And so that, just remembering those sort of taken for granted aspects of existence, led me to the next question of, what is alive and what is dead? I mean, a massive pillar of thought in our culture that spans science, religion, philosophy, is the human human supremacist one, the one that says human beings are the most acutely alive beings on the planet, and below us is this graded hierarchy of aliveness. And, you know, when I was growing up in school, it went something like humans, and then chimpanzees, and then dolphins and whales, and then on down to amoebas, and then everything else was non-living. And but when you dwell on those observations, that sort of blur the lines between, you know, the things you imbibe into you, which this culture deems non-living, that become this moving, living thing, those lines become fuzzy pretty quick. I know that I'm alive, but does that mean that only a small part of me is alive because I'm made up of mostly water and salt and these other things that are...
And all sorts of bacteria that don't have your DNA.
Right. Yeah, we're mostly made up of... somebody else. And so is my saltwater self dead? The human brain, or my brain, is 80% fat. And so, you know, is that part of me dead? I don't personally think so. And so that sort of, you know, questioning what is alive, what is not, bolstered by all of these other stories from all of these other cultures, who to them, the world is also alive. And those two things sort of led me to start talking about the world, speaking about the world and speaking to the world in a different way, referring to a forest as a whom rather than a that or a which. And I think this is intimately related to our work as environmentalists, because, you know, you could say that what we're dealing with as environmentalists is the fundamental disrespect of the world and of the earth. And if we ourselves are going to be the best, you know, environmentalists and social justice people we can, I think it would serve us in our respective movements to incorporate that more respectful way of speaking.
Okay, so now you've realized that you are a living being and that a forest is a living being too. So the world's been saved, right? I mean, that's it. Are we done? Once you've made that personal journey, is it over?
Right.
I mean, does that save everything just to change perception? Because that's something we hear all the time, is we need to have a paradigm shift. And
right.
So now that you've made that personal journey and you've changed your word choice from that to whom, so that by itself is going to save the planet, right?
Unfortunately, no. And I guess now we can go back to my initial interest in the big structural differences between our culture and others. And another thing, besides the cultural stories, is another thing I've been interested in is the social reward systems of different cultures. And that's one thing that became very apparent to me when studying anthropology, was that, and specifically Ruth Benedict really helped me understand this. And she, in the early part of the last century, did some cross-cultural research and discovered that there was a main difference between cultures that she deemed aggressive and the cultures that she deemed non-aggressive. And she said more than any other factor, it came down to social reward systems of these cultures. And she found that the aggressive cultures had social reward systems that rewarded individual behavior that benefited the individual at the expense of the group as a whole. And she found the opposite with the cultures she deemed non-aggressive. The non-aggressive cultures had reward systems that benefited, that rewarded behavior that benefited the group as a whole. And so in these aggressive cultures, wealth would often be being funneled from poor to rich constantly. And so that would breed this environment of competition and this view of the world as sort of if you don't fight for what you want, you're not going to get it kind of thing. And so insecurity was a big part of these aggressive cultures. And she called this sort of economic system a funnel system because of that funneling nature of wealth. And then
it's a dog-eat-dog system.
Dog-eat-dog world, yeah.
Yeah.
And in the non-aggressive cultures, it wasn't a dog-eat-dog world because wealth through the reward systems, wealth would be spread out. And any wealth that got accumulated into the hands of one or two or a few people would eventually be spread back out into the population through various, you know, whether it be social shaming or you know, annual ceremonies like the potlatch in Coast Salish communities. That's things like that would keep people from accumulating too much. And what she found in those cultures was that the environment was mostly one of security, because people weren't trying to compete with one another all the time to get theirs. And so when I learned about this, of course, I immediately put Ruth Benedict's lens onto our culture, and it was painfully clear to me that we are living in probably the largest funnel system economy to ever exist. And I mean, all you would have to do is look at the disparity between you know, the few CEOs in the world and everyone else, and just think about capitalist rhetoric. I mean, industrial capitalism seems to be the most funnel-like of funnel systems imaginable. It's hard for me to imagine anything more of a funnel system. So this is why, and that's just one reason why a personal change, a personal move towards purity is not going to do anything. And it's not something that we should spend very much energy on. We should only spend energy on it in so much as it allows us to then view these more fundamental problems and get to work organizing against them. So, yeah, that's an example of one of those reasons why we're dealing with big structural problems here. And individuals changing their minds is not going to instate a siphon system, which is the name that Ruth Benedict gave to the non-aggressive economies. Just by changing our minds and loving our neighbors and buying green and whatever you want to do or want to call it, it's not going to reverse that when the existence of this economy, those in power need this economy to exist, and they'll do whatever it takes to keep it in existence.
So we have about 12 or 13 minutes left. If personal change is not sufficient, what are you suggesting?
Well, I think the major problem with environmentalism, as it has come to be in this country and in the world, is just that a main one is that people haven't looked to the fundamental roots of this culture, and it goes beyond that we have too many cars. It goes beyond that not every grocery store has environmentally friendly things for sale in it. Because at the root, this culture needs to expand. And taking a leaf out of your books, Derek, the culture, you know, this dominant culture that I've been referring to, is the cultural phenomenon we most often call civilization. And civilization is the way of life characterized by city living and the emergence of cities and the constantly expanding culture that imperially accumulates by force anything it needs to keep on going. And So none of these proposed solutions are going to work. And I mean, let's just take the large-scale solutions that are being proposed these days, solar panels, wind turbines, alternative energy, you know, retrofitting the current industrial economy with, quote-unquote, renewable energy. And people rarely do much digging into what that would actually mean and what it actually means to produce these things in the first place. You know, solar panels. A single solar cell requires intensive rare earth mineral mining to get the minerals that it takes to for the panels themselves. You know, where are you going to get the copper? Those minerals are smelted by high powered or by high temperature oil powered furnaces. There's petroleum all along the way from extraction to production and manufacture to distribution to installation to maintenance, and that is never addressed. And so the big time solutions that seem to be coming from the top like that seem pretty bunk once you do a little bit of research. But basically we need a resistance movement at this point. 90% of the large fish in the ocean are gone. Scientists, every time I look at new climate science, it's scientists saying, oh, we've underestimated the speed and severity at which climate change is progressing yet again. Now, what was the worst-case scenario last year is now a more conservative prediction. This culture is using up the world. It's eating up the world at everyone's expense, including our own future generation of humans, and we're all on the chopping block here, and I think those of us who have the privilege that's been given to us by civilization, I think at this point have a responsibility to the world that birthed us and the world that sustains our every single breath to fight for it. And I find myself losing patience and losing tolerance every day, it seems. But I think we need a resistance movement. And so, yeah, I don't know if you want to have a more pointed question for that, or if you want me to expand on that.
Well, what I was thinking is this is being pre-recorded, and it will be played in the fall, but I just want to mention that it is being recorded as Death Valley is experiencing the highest temperatures ever recorded in North America. And, you know, Phoenix has been, what, 118, 116 the last couple of days? And I live in the rainforest of Northern California, and I've lived here 13 years, and it's the last 2 days have been the first days since I've lived here, the first night since I've lived here, that I've walked the forest at night without a sweater. I'm wearing a short-sleeve shirt at night, which doesn't happen here. And that's all anecdotal, of course, but things are going really fast. And I guess the question, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes, and the question I would really like to ask now, unless you want to go somewhere else with this, would be, if somebody wanted to start down some path toward, you mentioned resistance, you know, where might they begin? What do you want someone to do? Someone, you know, somebody who's listening to this who's 20 years old, 30 years old, 40 years old, 60 years old, 15 years old, whatever. What do you want them to do?
Well, I would say, first and foremost, I don't think anyone is going to do anything unless they're working from a place of love. And that might sound kind of cheesy, but I personally feel that I would not be able to sustain myself through the activist work I do if it were not for the places and creatures who I love and the prospect of them being destroyed by this culture. So I think the first thing that I would ask people to do is really to sit down and ask yourself, you know, what do you care about enough to fight for? And if you don't care enough about anything to fight for, look at that as a problem in and of itself, and then go from there. But I would really start with that. But once you've, you know, once you've done that and have decided that you want to, you know, to fight back, what we need is a movement, because we're dealing with such a huge thing and such little time. What I think we need is a movement, and what any movement needs is an effective strategy. And that means really identifying two things. You know, where is power weak and where are we strong? And the overlap is where we have to focus as a movement. So there is a lot of, it's always tough to tell people what to do, especially in this culture, but I think a few things to start out with that might be helpful is, you know, especially if you're alone in your area and you don't really have a lot of people who are on the same page as you, raising consciousness with the purpose of building organization and, you know, raising the level of struggle. Just get out there in your communities and start putting forward this idea that that things are urgent and we need to start building and making connections with each other.
And once you've, on a really simple level, and we need to do more than this, obviously, but on a really simple level, in standard conversations, start using the word who for us, and, you know, let people stare at you for a minute and then either move on or tell them why. I mean, once again, on a very, very small level. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And then after you do, you know, you're raising consciousness, a thing to do on that anyone can do on their own is to read about, read foundational and historical works about revolution and about social movements and resistance movements in general, especially written by those who have participated in and led them, because, you know, that's another thing that we need to get straight here, which is that the environmental movement is less like a movement than most other social movements I've learned about, because whether it's the civil rights movement or the resistance to apartheid or the resistance or the multiple resistances to the Nazis, these movements, all the movements that I've learned about have had multiple working parts, and oftentimes those parts go from an above-ground, nonviolent wing, but there's almost always an underground, more militant side of the struggle that makes the above-ground wing more successful. And even the civil rights movement fell into that with Martin Luther King and the nonviolent activists on one side and, you know, the whole slew of others, Deacons for Defense, Black Panthers, and the militant wing. So just looking at social movements and just seeing how they're structured would be another very important thing to do. Another thing to do, I would say, is to, once you've been reading about revolutionary ideas, find a way to give them a public presence. Find a way to articulate them in the public sphere. And I think a huge part of this is not just the ideas, but the spirit as well, and to celebrate and encourage fighting back for what you love, and because that's what this is about. And I think something I want to say straight off is that it's going to take a lot of patience, and especially in this culture where apathy is ruler, it's going to take a lot of work to win people over and make connections and make allies. So I guess creating resistance culture, a culture of resistance, and this means finding out what your gifts are and finding out what you really like to do. If you like making videos, if you like doing art, if you like to speak, if you like to sing, you know, ask yourself how those things can be sort of used in the service of the land or in the service of a larger struggle. In that, you know, writing blogs, writing books, making leaflets, writing stories, writing articles about the crimes of capitalism, and writing articles about the that celebrate resistance. You know, and if you lose friends over what you're doing, make new friends. It's happened for me. It's happened for my friends now, and that will happen, and that's something that people have to deal with, but you can always make new friends. And yeah, as opportunities arise, we need to take them. I cannot stress enough that we are going down, and things are getting worse every day, and the enemy is getting weaker by the day as well, as oil is dwindling and other things are dwindling, but it's not happening fast enough, and it's not going to go by itself. I really think that it needs our helping hand to die as quickly as possible if we want the Earth to live.
Well, that seems like a pretty good note to end on. Is there anything else you wanted to say, or is that good?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that's good.
Okay, well, I would like to thank you so much, Dylan, for being on here. And this has been Dylan Thompson and Derek Jensen on Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. So thank you very much for listening.